Good afternoon. Can you hear me? My name is Philip Wadler. I'm a professor in the School of Informatics at the University of Edinburgh. And I'm one of the staff members for the two Informatics 1 courses. The course head is Ewan Klein, who's sitting here.
Course organizer, technically speaking.
Oh, sorry.
I will give an introductory lecture, not today, but this time next week. So you'll see me again in a week's time.
We also have two wonderful TAs, Phil Scott and Zoe Leiper. So you will be seeing a lot of them. And we have lots of people who support the course in the informatics teaching organization. How many of you have figured out where the ITO is yet? Not too many of you, a couple of you. It's on the fourth floor of this building, and Tamisa's here as a representative of the ITO. She's not the main representative for the course. The main representative is Kirsten Belk, but Kirsten's away today. So Tamisa very kindly came to be the friendly face of ITO. And and I think you'll all get familiar with the ITO. So the point is that there are many resources available to help you, and we hope that you'll take advantage of that and learn how to use them well. Again, the main introductory lecture, which oddly enough is not today, I'll explain why in a minute, but will be given by Ewan Klein next week, will tell you a little bit more about those resources. I'll also be saying a little bit about them this morning. Informatics 1 has two parts. Informatics 1 FP, Functional Programming, which is this part here, and Informatics 1 Computation and Logic, which is the other half of the course, and is taught by Dave Robertson, who happens to also be head of the School of Informatics, and the teaching assistant is Tom French. So you can see from the fact that the head of school teaches one part of this course that we all take Informatics 1 very seriously. This is your introduction to informatics, to computing. It's our chance to get you excited about it, and we hope you will be excited about it and will enjoy it. This is a wee bit small because I just copied the bitmap off the web, but this is the schedule of the course. I'm not going to go into that in detail, but you can see that the functional programming courses are normally Monday at this time and Tuesday morning at 11:10. And then computation and logic is on Thursday morning and Friday afternoon. I'm just showing this to point out a couple of things. One is that the introductory lecture from Ewan Klein will be next Monday in this time slot. I won't be giving it because I won't be here. So there will be no slot on Tuesday. And then Dave Robertson has kindly agreed to swap with me, and I will be giving a lecture next Friday at 2 o'clock. So there's a slight hiccup in the schedule in the beginning weeks, which I wanted to show you. Now, Zoe, I know you wanted to get off. So does anybody have a question for Zoe before she goes? Not yet. OK. And if other people want to get away, I will let you do so. Anything else you want to say? OK. Thanks, guys. Your required text for this course, don't tell him the important secret I told all of you who are on time. Your textbook for this course is Haskell, The Craft of Functional Programming by Simon Thompson. Should be available in the bookstores. Quite possibly there's some students who've been through this course before who are willing to sell you a used copy at a lower price. I know it's expensive. I'm sorry it's expensive. That's what publishers do. They charge lots for these things. But it is important to make use of this. We've made sure that the library has several copies if you want to go read it in the library instead of publish your own copy. But each week, there is assigned reading. And it's very important that you get this and read through it. A lecture is a very limited amount of time. I would love to have more time and to lecture to you at great length so you can hear my beautiful voice and learn all about functional programming, but we can't do it all just in lectures. So do get the book and read it. The lectures are, in fact, the third most important way of conveying information to you. The book is the second most. And the most important way, which I'll be saying a bit more about, is the labs and tutorials. That is doing it yourself and getting immediate feedback from tutors in tutorials. So I'll say more about that as well. How many people have got a hold of the book already? Only just a few of you. Okay, lower than in previous years. Interesting. But please go out and get the book. I will ask you again if you've got it. You notice that you're already behind the reading because you're supposed to read chapters 1 through 3 by the beginning of this lecture. Now, obviously, that's ridiculous, so I'm not going to berate anybody for not having that done. But we do have a very heavy reading schedule very early on. We're going to try to work very quickly to get people up to speed. Right. By the end of this 3 weeks, you'll have done tutorials that demonstrate the same competence that you'll need in the class exam and the final exam. So we're going to get you up to speed very quickly. We know that some of you will go up to speed more slowly, and we have some provisions for that, which we'll talk about. But it's very important in the first few weeks that you pay attention, that you don't just say, oh, well, I'll catch up with that later. We're expecting you to do the work as we go along. And we've got lots of support systems in place, but of course, the most important thing is that you have a go at it. So you must all do the reading and try the exercises in the first few weeks as they're scheduled. We have our own computer system here called DICE. It's a variant of Unix. Most of you, I expect, will have used computers before. Let's just check. How many people have used a computer before? As I expected, that's most of you. Who has not used a computer before? Okay. Nobody is willing to admit it. How many of you have used a Windows PC before? Disgustingly many of you. How many of you have used a Macintosh? Quite a few of you. How many of you have used Unix? Quite a few of you. So the systems here are based on Unix, and there are training courses which you should have signed up for already. How many people have signed up for one of these introductory sessions? How many people have not signed up? Okay. If you go to the web page for the course, you will find links that will let you sign up for one of these introductory sessions. Please do so. One of the things that will happen in your career using computers is you will get to use lots of different computer systems, and you will be expected to get up to speed on them very quickly. So for those of you who don't know Unix yet, here's your chance. DICE is slightly different. I'm not sure if the differences will be very apparent to Unix users, but DICE is our own homegrown variant of Unix that's maintained by the support staff here. So there might be slight variance. Here, by the way, is the URL that you need to go to sign up for the course. So again, this is posted on the course web pages, and you can find it there. And from there, get to sign up. So please do that. Who signed up for the course this afternoon, just immediately following this? A fair number of you. Excellent. Good. People should stop me as I go on if they have any questions. Are there any questions yet? What's your question?
Is this functional programming?
Yes. Good. You asked a question. Excellent. It starts at 2 o'clock, by the way. Right. I mentioned that the labs are very important. There are always drop-in labs available. You're welcome to go home and do the homework on your own computer and then come in and bring that to the tutorials. That's perfectly fine. Or you can come in and do it in the labs. Right? We provide equipment for you to do it if you'd like. But be sure to do the tutorials every week. Do I have more about that? Yeah, I have more about that in a minute. So these are the times that the labs are open. Again, this is all posted on the web. The labs are in the computer labs west and north, which are in Appleton Tower. Raise your hand if you know where Appleton Tower is. Good. Raise your hand if you don't. No one will admit it. So we won't tell those who didn't admit it that they're actually sitting in it. For the first week, there's what's called the Lab Week exercise that you're going to submit online. Part of the exercise tells you how to do that. I think it's not quite up on the website yet, but it will be up later today or early tomorrow. And then you'll have until Friday to complete it. It says under here, do all the parts. That's because there's several pages to it. And I think part 3 is how to submit it, and then part 4 is more work involving running a program that will print some chessboards for you. And last year, people said, oh, I was so relieved when I submitted it that I didn't notice there was more to do. So I feel silly saying this, but of course, the first thing that happens when you get an assignment is to check all the parts and actually do everything you're asked to do, not stop halfway through. So that'll be due this Friday at 1 o'clock. For all the succeeding weeks, there will be tutorials. So these will start in week 3. This is week 1. Tuesday and Wednesday, you'll be assigned to tutorials for computation and logic. Thursday and Friday, so that means Thursday or Friday, you will have a functional programming tutorial. Everybody has one tutorial. It's very important that you make an attempt to do the work before the tutorial. Here is the way you learn. Now, this is so important, I'm going to jump up and down to wake up those of you who fell asleep. Okay? Don't panic. This is important. This is the way you learn. The way you learn is by doing the exercises and failing to do them. Now, some of you will be great and you will do the exercise the first time with no problem. That's wonderful. We're very happy with that. But if you do the exercise and you don't, and you fail and you get in trouble in some way, that is fine. That is how learning takes place. It's very unusual that you can just sit down and do everything the first time you try it. Those of you who do sit down and do it the first time you try it, you will realize that even by doing it, rather than just by reading about it, it has sunk into your brain in a new way, and you have new confidence about what's going on. So even if, you know, so don't be disappointed if you do it the first time. Even just by doing it the first time, you've learned something. But if you don't do it, that's fine. That's how you learn what you don't understand and get to the point that you can learn it. Now, once you've done that, there are many, many resources available to you. Right? One resource is the drop-in labs. The drop-in labs have demonstrators in them. Once you've gotten stuck, then one of the things you can do, and you should feel free to do this, this is what the demonstrators are there for, is go to a demonstrator and say, I'm stuck. Can you help me get unstuck, please? Another thing you can do is go to one of your fellow students. Another thing you can do is that the Computing Society here has a group of Cascaders, which are students who've come through the course before and who want to help out. And they usually have some icon on them. I think it's a moose. So if you see anybody carrying a moose around, you know you can ask them a question. So do the work before the tutorial. Bring a printout. Of course, you can ask the tutor as well. But you know, don't leave it all till the last minute. Don't fail to get it done at the last minute and then bring it in and say, I couldn't do it. Right? What you should be doing is making your best effort to get it done, including consulting with other people. And then the tutor can help straighten you out on really tricky parts. That's when the tutorials are most effective. But by all means, bring a printout of your work to the tutorial so that the tutor can see what you've done and what you haven't done. Right? You would think it's absolutely obvious that to take advantage of the tutor, what you need to do is bring the tutorial work you've done so the tutor can look over it. But I know from having taught many tutorials myself that students don't always do this. So I'm sorry to say the completely obvious, but bring the work to the tutorial. You can bring it on your laptop so you can run it, or you can bring it printed out. Please do try to print it out, right? Because even just getting the bloody laptop, sorry, bloody is a technical term that we use for computers. Even just getting the bloody laptop booted up is, you know, sometimes fails, whereas printouts almost always work. So if you bring a printout with you, it'll just be easier and quicker for the tutor to look over what you've done and give you feedback. As I mentioned, you may collaborate. You are encouraged to collaborate. It's perfectly fine to work with your fellow students and to get them to help you out and for you to help them out. But in the end, of course, you need to sit the exam on your own. And in the end, of course, you want to know the material. It's no good if just your friends know the material. You want to know it yourself. So it's a good idea to get people to help you out, but please be careful when you do that, that you're not actually having them do the work for you. You must learn from the process. If you don't, you won't learn anything, right? It's completely tautologous. So I hope this is, again, completely obvious. I'm sorry for belaboring it, but it is very important that you learn to do it yourself. And again, the reason I'm saying this is that I know in the past, many people, I think often without meaning to, fall into the trap that they believe they can do it, but in fact, it's their friends have been helping them over the hard part every single time. We'll be trying to set extra work for you so that once you've had one that you got stuck on, that you can then go and find another one to do that hopefully you will not get stuck on, and that way you'll have convinced yourself that you've learned the material properly. You will discover, here, I'll show you now, right? Here's the marking scheme for this course. So you have the lab week exercise next week, then you have a bunch of tutorials, then there's a class test, then a bunch more tutorials, and a mock test, and a last tutorial, and then the final exam. And you will see that a tiny bit of the marks go on the class test, and all the rest is on the final exam. So you might think, well, that's kind of unfair. Why haven't you put some marks on this bit? Well, the reason there are no marks on that bit is so that you understand precisely what these bits are for. These are how you learn. They aren't how we assess you. They are there for you to learn. That's the only reason that they're there. Now, assessment I regard as a necessary evil. Right? But I hope the purpose that we're all here in university, me and you together, is to learn. So the key part of the course is the bits that you learn from. So the way you can tell something is important is if we've rated it 0%. 0% means this is vital. Now, because it's rated 0%, there's no point in doing it well. The point in doing it is to learn from it, right? So you don't want a polished, absolutely perfect-looking solution, except as that helps you learn how to produce polished, perfect-looking solutions for when you are assessed, the class test, and the final exam. In other words, working with other people is fine and is encouraged as long as you learn from it. That's what they're there for. And of course, because you don't get extra marks for getting it right, you can afford to get it wrong. That's why we give you 0%. And in particular, it means it's fine to collaborate, but you're not encouraged to collaborate when you don't need to. You're not encouraged to plagiarize in any way, to steal the answer, to get it right just for the sake of getting it right. The only reason for doing the tutorial is not to get it right, but so you can learn from it. Of course, getting it right is a corollary of that, but it means there's never an incentive to cheat just to get it right. The reason to collaborate with people is not to get the right answer to hand in, the reason to collaborate with people is to learn. Just checking if there's anything else. Okay, so I think I've touched on all the important points there. So this is the ending of the admin bit, and then I'm going to go on and talk a bit about some different pieces of content. So I thought now's a good time to stop and ask for questions. Are there any questions about all that? Yes?
Are there any facilities to print off in the university?
Are there facilities to print off in the university? Yes, the labs have printers. And I think you can even log into the networks and send things remotely to the printers. That would be a good thing to ask about at the sessions on using the system that have been scheduled. But excellent question. Thank you. Any other good questions? No other questions? Yes?
When are the tutorials? Like, at which time?
When are the tutorials? You've all been assigned to tutorial sessions already. You might have been assigned at a time you can't go, although we've tried to avoid that. But if that happens, then you contact the ITO and ask to swap. You should all have had an email telling you which page all the tutorials are listed on. Is that right? Who's had an? Yeah, raise your hand if you've had such an email. Good. Raise your hand if you've not, if you have no idea. OK, you should all have received such a thing. Have you checked in and looked at your university email? OK, so anybody who's not seen such a thing, please go to the ITO or contact them, and they will sort you out. The ITO is on the fourth floor of this building. OK? Yes?
How much of prior knowledge of programming languages are we expected to have, or will that be important to us as we go?
Good question. How much prior knowledge of programming languages are you expected to have? None. We do not assume you have any prior experience with computing whatsoever. As you've seen, most of you have prior experience with computers. Many of you won't have done programming before. I'll say a bit more about that later on. But that's a very good question, and the answer is no, you're not expected to have experience. By the way, I'm trying to repeat the questions when you ask. If I don't, remind me to. Hopefully that Wii video camera in the back of the room is turned on, and all of this gets videoed and is then available online. Which is bad for me, because it means if I do anything silly, the whole world can see it. But it's good for you, because it means if you want to review the lectures, it's easy to do so. Question?
Online where? You said it's online, but where?
Oh, online where? It will be linked again from the web page for the course. There's no links to that yet, because there aren't any up yet, but there will be some. If you have any difficulty finding the course, of course, you can just say Informatics 1 Edinburgh to Google, and it will pop up right away. OK, that's an excellent set of questions, which I'm very pleased by. Normally, everybody just sits there very quiet. I sometimes feel that one purpose of primary and secondary school is to teach people that when somebody says, are there any questions, that the way you look good is by pretending that you know everything and just sitting there. So at higher levels, I can assure you, asking questions makes you look good. When I've gone to job interviews for candidates, when I've gone to research conferences, you find that the people who are asking all the questions are the most clever and most confident people. So if you want to look clever and confident, when you don't know something, ask a question. Now, I've got a secret technique for asking questions, because often I'll be sitting through a lecture and somebody will say something and I will have no idea of what they've just said. And I think, oh, I am so stupid. You know, this is on topic X. I'm not up on topic X. Everybody else in this room knows all about X, and this person just said something that they all know and I don't know. So my secret is, when that happens, I lean to the person next to me, and I whisper, right? This person has just said the word blurbal, and I don't know what a blurbal is. And I lean to the person next to me, and I say, excuse me, what's a blurbal? And usually the person sitting next to me leans over and says, I have no idea what a blurbal is. I thought I was supposed to know. Oh, no. So if I start talking about blurbals, and you don't know what blurbals are, If you're confident, just ask and say, you know, hey, Phil, what's a deliverable? But if you're worried that everybody else knows and you don't know, then lean to the person next to you and say, what's a deliverable? And when they say, I don't know, then you know that there are at least two of you, right? And the odds are there are probably many, many more people sitting in this lecture hall who will be absolutely delighted with you when you raise your hand and say, excuse me, what's a deliverable? And I will be delighted with you as well. Because, of course, I should have explained to you what a deliverable is, and I forgot. So please don't hesitate to ask questions. And if you're worried that's something that everybody else knows, try that technique. Of course, you need to sit next to somebody for it to work. You'll have to turn around and ask the person behind you. And then I'll know that there's something that I said that somebody didn't know. And finally, right, my secret goal for this course, of course, I want you to learn about computing. I want you to learn about programming languages. I want you to learn about functional programming, which I love greatly, and I hope you will love as well. But I have another secret goal for the course, which is if you come through it with the confidence to just ask a question when you don't know, I think that will be brilliant. If you come through it with the confidence to say, you know, I can find this stuff out. I can do research. I can go where other people haven't gone and work out new things that nobody else has worked out before. That would be the best thing of all. And asking questions is the first part of that. So please don't hesitate to ask questions. You'll make me very happy by asking questions, and you'll improve a very important skill within yourself if you learn to ask questions at the right time. Are there any questions about asking questions? Darn. Okay, so in the remaining time, we have until 2:50. I'm not quite sure how far I'll get. I'm going to be covering two things in the remaining slots today. One is a little bit of the scene setting for what functional programming is. And then depending on the time available, I will begin to actually show you some of the content of functional programming. We won't get through all that, and I will continue with that tomorrow morning. How many people, before they signed up for this class, had heard the term functional programming? Maybe about half of you, okay. How many had heard of the programming language Haskell? Also maybe about half of you. Wow, that's amazing. When I started this course 7-odd years ago, that was a much smaller proportion. And how many of you have actually written a program in Haskell? One hand going up. Two hands. Three, four. Hands sort of half going up. You've written half a program in Haskell. So, one thing that you should all take away immediately is that, with the possible exception of the person standing at the front, nobody in this room is a Haskell expert. Right, now, there will be some of you expert in other languages. How many people have written programs in Java? Right, a much larger number. How many people consider yourselves expert in some programming language? Oh, everybody. There's one fellow. OK. Most people are being modest. But there are a few of you in here I know who are well-skilled programmers already, but not in Haskell. So to go back to the very good question that was asked before, are we expecting people who are experienced? Well, we know some people are experienced, and we know some people are not experienced. And one thing that we do to put everybody on an even keel is teach a language that none of you have bumped into before, or very few of you have, so that everybody's much more on an even keel. That's one reason that we do this. Now, there's some others as well. So I'll say more about that in a bit. But let's go back and just talk about informatics for a minute. This is one of my favorite quotes. In their capacity as a tool, computers will be but a ripple on the surface of our culture. In their capacity as intellectual challenge, they are without precedent in the cultural history of mankind. So this is a quote from Edska Dijkstra, a very well-known computer scientist. He won the Turing Award, which is the equivalent of the Nobel Prize for computing. As you can tell from this, he was not given to understatement. Back when he wrote this was, I think, between 1970 and 1980, maybe even the late 60s. So at that point, sort of, computers were just a ripple on the surface of our culture. It was not the case back then that everybody walks around as they do now with a computer in their pocket. And I've now revealed to you that I'm the only person in this room who doesn't own an iPhone. But everybody walks around with a computer in their pocket, right? Computers have an immense impact as a tool on our culture. Nonetheless, I think he was correct that their greatest impact is not going to be as a tool, but as something that affects the cultural history of mankind. Now, in his usual understated way, he said they are without precedent. But I think there are actually two precedents, but they're quite important ones. Reading, mathematics. In other words, prose, the ability to write things down as sentences and for other people to read them, and mathematics, the ability to write and manipulate equations. Okay? Those have both had some impact on the cultural history of mankind. You are at the dawn of the third great wave. You are the people best placed to do for computing the equivalent of what Newton, say, did for mathematics. Right? I dearly hope that one of you sitting in this room is going to be the person who has an apple land on their head, possibly one of these. Oops, it's come undone. Have the equivalent of an apple landing on your head and coming up with the equivalent of the universal law of gravitation. Have no doubt that there are principles that important about computing that we haven't discovered yet. And you really are in the right place to discover those. So literally, it's very hard for me to think of anything as exciting or wonderful as computing to do. There's some wonderful things happening in biology as well, right? Particularly with sequencing DNA and so on. And of course, they're related. Because what they've discovered in biology is that DNA, which encodes for proteins, well, that's all about transmitting information, which of course is exactly what informatics is about. So the great advances happening in biology and the great advances happening in informatics are deeply linked. And one of the most exciting institutes that you can belong to now in the School of Informatics is the institute that deals with the impact of informatics on biology. So for instance, using programming languages to model what happens in the cell as a new way of understanding, well, what can be going on in the cell? You view it as information processing. And that gives you new insights into what's going on. There are, by the way, just two things, right? We call it informatics. Why do we call it informatics? Everybody else calls it computer science. Why don't we call it computer science? So again, Edsger Dijkstra had something important to say about this. He says, computer science is no more about computers than astronomy is about telescopes. Right? So you're going to spend a lot of time with this piece of hardware, or whatever piece of hardware you use, the computer, and of course, it's a lot of fun, right? It lets you do things and see things that you couldn't see before, just like a telescope lets you see things that you couldn't see before. But don't get lost in this thing. What we want you to see is the stars. Right? It's about the ideas underlying it. That's the important thing. So the way I like to put this is the name computer science is a perfectly good name except for two things. It has the word computer in it, and it has the word science in it. Other than that, it's fine. Computer is wrong because it's not about computers. It's about the ideas that they let us deal with. And science is wrong because informatics is a science. And if you are a science, you do not put science in your name. Right? They do not say physics science, or chemistry science, or biology science, or social science. Well, they do say social science, but maybe that proves my point. So we shouldn't have science be part of our name, because we are a science, and we should just have the confidence to do that. So this is why I think informatics is quite a good choice of name. And by the way, with informatics had been used as a name for this subject within France before. They sometimes call it informatique. But it was the school here that first popularized the use of the name informatics, and then many other institutions throughout the UK have picked up on that. Okay, so we're going to learn functional programming this course. As I've hinted, we're going to learn a particular functional programming language called Haskell. Why? Well, one reason why is it's important to learn many different programming languages over your career. So by starting with one that's less popular, in the second half of the course you learn Java, which is a more popular one. But by starting with one that's less popular, we hope to inculcate in you the idea that you will learn many, many different programming languages over your career. And it's important to be able to absorb new ones as they come along. So we're starting as we mean to go on. And then something that I quite like about Haskell is you will find that it works at a higher level. We sometimes say a higher level of abstraction. And what this means is if you write a Java program for a task and a Haskell program for a task, you will find that the Haskell program is a lot shorter. So you'll just have a lot less writing to do for your assignments and a lot less reading to do when you read a program that somebody else has written. So this way it makes things a bit easier for you. As you will find, Haskell is mainly about two things, the function and the list. And Haskell has many operators, such as list comprehensions, that let you operate on an entire list at once. So in Java, typically instead of lists, you would have arrays, and typically what you would do is you would have a little loop, and the loop would go around, and the little computer says, okay, I is 0, so I look at the 0th element of the array, and I do something with that. And then I is 1, so I look at the 1 element of the array, and I do something with that. And then I is 2, I do something with the 2 element of the array, and then I'm really bored by now, but I'm a computer. Computers don't get bored. Okay, so now I do element 3, and so on. Whereas in Haskell, you can just say, do this to the whole list at once. Map square over the list, square every element of the list. So the way I like to think of it, it is in languages like Java, it's sort of ticky, 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 ticky. And in Haskell, it's whoosh. So we thought it'd be fun to start you off in your programming career by teaching you to whoosh. And it's not just a matter of language, right? You will understand eventually how you can write Java programs that operate on an entire data structure at once. All of the techniques that we teach you in Haskell can be done in Java, but they are more complicated to do. But by giving you a language where it's easy to operate on the whole thing at once, we hope we will have raised your mind to the level that when you see a new problem, instead of thinking of, how do I do this to the first element of the array, and then the second, and then the third, you will think, what can I do here to set things up so that I will whoosh through the problem? So that's our second reason for teaching Haskell. And then the third reason, which we've already touched on, is that none of you have seen Haskell before, and so it puts both the experienced and the inexperienced programmers on more of an equal footing. I won't pretend that some of you who've seen programming before will find things a bit easier because you have that programming experience, but we're trying to put things on more of an equal footing, recognizing that we have a very diverse input in this class. I thought I saw a hand go up. Are there any questions? Please give me a question. I like questions. No questions. Oh well. Okay. So what is Haskell? It's what's called a functional programming language. What that means is instead of looking at some memory location and working out how to read a word out of that or to write a word into it and change it, we never change anything. We just talk about operations on values that yield new values, but those values can be very complex. It might be a simple value like an integer. It might be a list of integers. It might be a character or a list of characters or a list of characters and so on. Or it might be a function or a list of functions and so on. So pure basically means we don't change anything. We just take values and give you new values. One colleague suggested, well, they've got object-oriented programming, we should talk about value-oriented programming. But we use the older name, which is functional programming. It's lazy. That's mainly just a buzzword for now, but what it means is it's actually sometimes more efficient because it only does a computation when it needs to. Why did I put in here that it uses type classes? It does. This makes it very easy to operate over many different data types. When it was designed, its goal was that it should be for use in education, research, and industry. And it is used in all three of those things. I'll say a little bit more about its use in industry a bit later. It was designed by a committee. You have all heard the saying that an elephant is a mouse designed by a committee. But it doesn't quite look too elephantine, fortunately. And it recently celebrated its 20th birthday. Every 15 years, there is a research conference called HOPL, History of Programming Languages, where they invite papers on the history of major programming languages. So we were actually invited to write a paper about Haskell. And here's a list of the authors. You will see that I'm one of them. And I guess I have to come clean now and admit that I'm one of the people who designed Haskell. So there's a large committee of us, about 20 or so people for the first version. But there were four editors, and I was the first editor of the first report. Every year, I mentioned conferences. Every year, there's an international conference on functional programming. Last year, it was here in Edinburgh. I was the local arrangements chairman. This year, it's happening in Baltimore. I didn't put up a picture of Baltimore. It didn't look very interesting. But this is why you're having a strange schedule this year, is I must go to Baltimore for this conference next week, and that's why I can't be here. So I'm sorry, but I'm forced to go there. It's part of my duties. I'm the chair of the, here it says here, ACM SIG Plan. SIG Plan is the Special Interest Group on Programming Languages. It sponsors this conference and many others, and I'm the chair of it, and we have a meeting there next week, so I have to go there for the meeting. But it means I will come back. I hope I will have some fresh news for you about something nobody's ever done with functional programming before that I can tell you about. The conference every year has sponsors. Here are the sponsors of it this year. And of course, these people wouldn't be sponsoring it if they didn't use it. So you'll notice that there's a large number of banks here. James Street Capital, Standard Chartered, Credit Suisse. James Street Capital, they sort of have a trade secret that gets them ahead of everybody else, which is that they write all their programs in a different functional programming language, OCaml. So you're going to learn not OCaml, but the same principles that underlie all functional languages. Standard Chartered and Credit Suisse are both banks, and they do lots of work in Haskell. Galois is a company that was founded to say, well, if Haskell's so good, we should be able to write programs in Haskell more quickly and more cheaply than anybody else. We should just be able to market ourselves to industry as, if you have a problem, we will solve it for you more quickly and more cheaply than other companies and make our money that way. And that's what they've done. And they have some of the best Haskell programmers in the world that work for Galois. Erlang is a programming language designed by Ericsson, who makes telephones and telephone switches. Telephone switches have to be very reliable. They have the only phone switch in the world, as far as I know, that has 9 nines reliability. That means it stays up 99.9999999% of the time. If you work that out, that's a downtime of less than a few seconds per year. So it's very hard to actually measure that something is that reliable. And that's written in a functional language called Erlang. And then Microsoft Research. Microsoft recently has released a new research language called F#, which is a functional language. And in fact, you'll notice that the compiler for Haskell we use is maintained by other researchers, notably Simon Peyton-Jones and Simon Marlowe, who used to be colleagues of mine, who are now at Microsoft Research. So Microsoft has a large investment now in functional programming, and all functional programmers are really excited because Haskell's not an official product of Microsoft. They unofficially support it. But F-sharp is an official product. It's part of Visual Studio and so on. And we're very interested to see how the world behaves now that they can get a official commercial product from Microsoft, no less, that's a functional language. So it may, if you watch what happens on the bulletin boards and so on, there's much more interest in functional programming than there used to be. And it will be interesting to see how that plays out. I just want to reiterate two buzzwords, functional and object-oriented. These are two main families of programming languages. Java, which you're going to learn next term, is a functional language. Sorry. Java is an object-oriented language, whereas Haskell, which we're learning this term, is a functional language. Languages like F-sharp actually have characteristics of both. I thought I would also mention just briefly Scala, which you can again see on both lists. Scala is was developed by a colleague of mine, Martin Odersky, and it's sort of what Java would be like if it were a functional language, whereas F-sharp is sort of what C-sharp would be like if it was a functional language. So both of these are attracting a lot of interest in the industrial world. So I mentioned the Ericsson AXE phone switch, but all of these are examples of different places that are making use of functional programming in some way. One of the most important is you're going to learn about map and fold. Another name for fold is reduce, and in fact, the key component in the Google search engine is something called MapReduce, which they named because it's not a functional language, but they were very much inspired by exactly the same principles you're going to learn in this course. And all these different systems, which some of you might have heard of, and then Yahoo and Twitter and places like Facebook don't do their main programming in functional languages, but they often have some subsidiary programming that they do. One of the things attached to the International Conference on Functional Programming is the Conference on Commercial Uses of Functional Programming, workshop on commercial uses of functional programming. And people from Yahoo and Twitter and Facebook have all made presentations there about the ways in which they're using functional languages. Garbage collection is a technical term, but I didn't put it down, which we'll encounter later. But I didn't put it down here for this reason. One of the applications of functional programming that I was most excited about when I saw it was a use of functional programming for garbage collection that is the engine of a garbage truck was programmed in Haskell. What could be more cool than that? And this guy who came to give the talk at the commercial uses of functional programming came in with this big piece of metal, which was part of the engine for the garbage truck, and passed it around. And we all touched it and went, ooh. Right. As I mentioned, F-sharp and Scala, and also Erlang, because that also comes from a commercial company, are attracting a lot of interest from developers. And functional programming is also important because many features from it end up migrating elsewhere. So garbage collection, I mentioned, it's a way of keeping track of the space you're using. And older programming languages like C didn't use it. It was pioneered in Lisp, an early functional language. All functional languages use it. And then with Java and the languages that followed it, everybody started using garbage collection. So now all new programming languages use garbage collection, which came from functional languages. Higher order functions, similarly, were central to functional languages and have only recently migrated into other languages. Not, even the first version of Java didn't support them. Even the current version doesn't support them very well. C-sharp has a bit more support, and then things like Python and Perl, not their first versions, but their most recent versions, have added support for this. Similarly for generics, all of these are things we'll say more about. Similarly for comprehensions, and similarly for type classes, which have made it into C++ as something called concepts, and sort of made it into the generics of Java as well. So the point is, that I'm trying to make here, is that many features in functional languages lead the way. MapReduce for Google is another example. So I hope that will motivate you in studying functional programming to realize, there are good ideas here that maybe people aren't using elsewhere in the world, and we can push those out into the world and get more people to use them. Okay, so we're just at the time when we should be winding down. The next bit is the starting technical content, but I'm perfectly happy to leave that for Tuesday morning. Are there any questions about what I've just said? Yes.
From this impression, I get that the functional programming languages are much better than object-oriented and all other languages. And why are they less used?
Ah, very interesting question. So the impression that you got from the talk is that functional languages are better than object-oriented languages. But as I mentioned, they're much less widely used. So why would that be? Very good question. I think it has to do with economics. It's very important in a programming language to use one that other people use. This is called a network effect in economics. Something is much more valuable if other people use it. So I believe it has to do with network effects, and that over time, that may fade, and that you will find that functional languages are more prevalent. But we have to wait and see. But technical excellence doesn't always correspond to being widely used. The most famous example of that is VHS versus Betamax, two formats for storing videos on tape. And VHS won out and became the standard, even though Betamax was technically superior, and this is widely referred to. Only recently did I find out what it was that caused VHS to succeed where Betamax failed. Does anybody know the standard explanation for this? So, yes? That VHS were longer, so I haven't heard that explanation. That could be correct, but I really like the one I heard. I hope nobody will be embarrassed by this, but the explanation I heard was that VHS succeeded over Betamax because that was what the pornography publishers standardized on. So you needed a VHS player to play pornography, and that was enough to push VHS over the edge and for it to become the standard everywhere else. So I'm just waiting for functional programming to discover the equivalent of pornography. So we'll stop there, and I'll see you tomorrow morning. It should be available in the bookstore. It should be available in the bookstore, and it should be available over Amazon. As I said, there might be some students who used copies. And why didn't you ask that during the lecture? I bet lots of people had the same question. Right. There is interlinking between the courses, so that we draw a lot of examples from the other half of the course. What's your main subject?
Yeah.
Economics and maths.
Yeah.
Right. Is it for? Well, we'd love to have you in the course. You might find it slightly tougher going, but I don't think it should be impossible.
Without
the other? Yeah. No, it's here. So for teaching, it's based on the ITO on the fourth floor of this building.